This heliotropism appears side effect of heat-seeking behaviour used for hunting at night. Could be hijacked? Used against them? But how determine level of radiant heat that will activate tropic behaviour? Contrast with background ambient temperature probably crucial, hence no heat-seeking by day. Higher overall temperatures degrade contrast. Middle level. Fact. She cannot be human. Fact. She cannot be hungry. Define anomalies. Strength and speed clearly outside human range, but within observed parameters for hungries. Also, hungries did not respond to her, did not identify her as prey, but she showed volition. Reacted to non-food stimulus. Made conscious, creative use of environment. Me. Is she new? Determine ontological status. Priority, urgent. Lowest level. Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan. Rena, 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 Rena. Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan, Dr. Khan. This is shorthand for a great many things. Thoughts he does not wish at the moment to examine too closely. It hurts him to make Rena unhappy. She is important, in a way that other people are not important. She is an exception to every rule. She can look at him, and even touch him. He is able to listen to her voice without counting the syllables of her words, or breaking them down by grammatical and instrumental function. He supposes he loves her. Love is a word that people use about other people all the time, and Greaves has assembled a reasonably clear idea of its many contradictory reference. For more than half of these reference, he can place a positive mark against Dr. Khan's name in a polydimensional matrix that he has imagined. He knows, though, that the matrix does not accurately model what he feels for her. It only defines a logical space that she partially inhabits. After he came to Beacon, after he went to Dormitory 12, Rena came and found him. "We refugees have got to stick together," she said. And she held something out for him to take. Two somethings. Captain Power and Captain Power's voice box. The captain had fallen from Greaves' hand when he was carried from the transport into the orphanage. Greaves had heard the crack when he hit the concrete. Dr. Khan must have found the toy, broken, and she evidently remembered how determinedly Greaves had held on to it as they marched out of London. Remembering, she took the trouble to come and bring the two pieces to him when she found them. And as he took the captain back, with an interior lurch of relief and wonder, she sang to him. In a soft murmur that none of the other children or adults in the crowded room could hear. "He's the hero of the spaceways, the galactic engineer." She stopped at that. Most likely she didn't remember the rest of the words, about the Terran Code and the Planetary League and how the captain fights for truth. Greaves thinks of that day as the start of their relationship. On the journey from London he had been aware of her, but only in the same way that he was aware of all the other people in the refugee column. At that moment, she became Dr. Khan, and later still, Rena. Like the girl at the water testing plant, she sits in a category of one, an anomaly. For Greaves, growing up in Beacon was like a years-long walk across a minefield, very lonely and very arduous. Except that the errors were marked not by explosions but by humiliations, so there wasn't even the hope that a final fatal misstep would make it all go away. The teachers at the school and the wardens at the orphanage tried to protect him when they noticed him at all, but Beacon was a refugee camp with a million people trying to find a place to stand, in a space too small for half that number. People fought to the death in the streets for frost-gnawed carrots and wire-trapped rats. The laws were just the same brawl being fought in a wider theatre. And Greaves found that every act of kindness brought, reliably, its own reprisal. If a teacher gave him a book to read, an older child would take it from him, to trade it away for food or just to enjoy the experience of power, and beat him for the sin of having it in the first place. The key to survival was not being noticed at all. Until suddenly the key was Rena. She took him out of school for weeks at a time to teach him herself, in her canvas-walled lab, to teach him science mostly, but other things too. She reasoned that if he loved the captain, he would have a taste for science fiction and fantasy in general. So she introduced him to Asimov and Clarke, then Mieville and Gaiman and Le Guin. He had already learnt to read, but now he learned the pleasure of stories, which is like no other pleasure. The experience of slipping sideways into another world and living there for as long as you want to. In the streets, now, he walked with slightly more assurance. Beacon was growing older along with him. Curfews had been introduced and a hard labour farm for people guilty of breaches of public order. Greaves carried Alice and Ged and Coraline and Grenebulin in his head, along with the captain, and talked with them when the external world became problematic. But that happened less and less. He had found out what happiness was, and therefore was able to realise that he hadn't been happy up to now. He stopped going to school, gave up his bed at the orphanage. He laid out a bedroll on the floor of Dr. Khan's lab each night and stowed it in a corner each morning. Rena's presence became his peace. Her voice told him ceaselessly, whatever else she might be saying, that he was home. Greaves's memory is eidetic and perfect, a complete record of his past to which new information is added at a steady rate of 1 second per second. It isn't possible for him to forget. But sometimes when he remembers his mother, her hands washing his face, her face smiling down into his crib, her body cooling beside his on blood-soaked gravel, she has Dr. Khan's face. His brain has performed a semantic substitution between two nearly identical signs. So if there were a feasible way to give her what she wants, a promise that he will not expose himself to unnecessary danger, he would do it. He would very much like to offer her that reassurance, but he can't. Because unless he can find some new insight in the remaining months of the mission will fail. Unless. Middle level. Unless the girl is what she seems, different from the human baseline and from the Hungries. New. Fitting into a space whose shape I can't define yet or even hypothesize. And that's good. That's very good. If known factors permit of no solutions, any solution must come from a space beyond what is known. Focus. The priorities haven't changed. It's only that the list of variables has lengthened. Lengthened in a way that shows promise. Top level. But is it the top level anymore, or is she? Summary of environmental factors found to inhibit or retard the spread of the Hungry pathogen. None. Greaves pauses, staring at the word with the top of the pencil pressed hard against his lower lip. There are thousands of pages of mission logs and experimental notes in the double-reinforced filing cabinet underneath the lab's main centrifuge, but their substantive findings can be factored down to that single word. Dr. Fournier's team has studied, tabulated and graphed the effects on the Hungries of temperature, sound, atmospheric pressure, wind speed, relative and absolute humidity, light, duration and intensity. Presence or absence of 53 trace elements in air and soil, thermoperiod, acidity and alkalinity, macro and micronutrients, and the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. They have done this both through their own sampling and through extensive study of the specimen caches left for them by the crew of the Charles Darwin. The hope was to find an inhibitor, a weakness they could seize on and weaponize. If the pathogen was adversely affected by any of these things, Beacon and its inhabitants could adjust accordingly. They could make themselves as inhospitable an environment as possible for the disease to take root in. But Cordyceps is robust and hardy. Its onset and progress are the same in every case. Human tissue suits it well and anchors it against all trials and tribulations. human blood nourishes and waters it. Which, as far as Greece can see, leaves only two options. One is to synthesize a vaccine or a cure, and the team are nowhere on that. He has seen Dr. Akinwe's reports, knows that they're years away from means of countering the infection or guarding against it. The other option is what he has been working on all this time. Behavioral observation of Hungary's in the field. He is trying to build up a map of how the fungus shapes and repurposes the mammalian brain. A human body is not the environment Cordyceps was originally designed for, however much it has made itself at home there. It started out as a parasite on insects. So perhaps the fit isn't perfect. Perhaps it's loose enough that he can find an exploit, a behavioural trigger that will make the Hungrids damage themselves or swerve away and find some other prey. Middle level. Was she real? He hates to think that thought, let alone write it. But he doesn't flinch because you can't rule any hypothesis out until you've disproved it. It has occurred to Greaves before now to wonder about his own sanity, defined as the accuracy of the assessments he makes of the world around him and its processes, of the men and women around him and their behaviours, and of course of himself as separate from all of the above, a unique system that he observes from the inside. He knows his brain isn't like everyone else's. He is painfully aware that people in general take pleasure from things that terrify him, are afflicted by things that fascinate him. On the whole, he has learned to live with those differences. But suppose they are indications of some deeper difference that amounts to damage, dysfunction. To go mad, to lose your mind, which is the only thing that's really yours because it's really you, that would be an inexpressibly terrible thing. And at the same time, it would be nothing, because you yourself would be unable, from within that damaged state, to recognize or reflect on it. Greaves considers this paradox. He is afraid of something that may already have happened. No. He is afraid of its consequences, of the queasy, unsettling possibility that he has lost touch with reality and can never rejoin it. He is sure that the anomalous girl was real. Almost. Almost sure. She had the fearsome clarity of a hallucination, but still, a thought occurs to him. He undoes the buttons on his jacket, pulls up his t-shirt and examines the flesh beneath. In one small area, roughly ellipsoidal, with a long radius of 3 centimetres and a short radius of 2, his skin is yellow, deepening to blue. He is bruised in the place where she touched him, where her heel kicked off from him. Greaves nods, satisfied. Top level. The Hungries have night behaviours and day behaviours, but all my observations have taken place during daylight. The use of thermal sensory organs or organelles for hunting by night was confirmed by Caldwell et al. In the third and last of their WHO reports. The absence of a normal sleep cycle has been argued by Selkirk and Bales, but the evidential base is slender. A few hours of observation in each case, from a camouflaged hide whose armour and defences restricted vision and kept the Hungries at a distance. To see them at night, up close, might yield valuable insights. But Greaves can't lie, even to himself. If I go into Invercrae, and if she's there, I might find her. Study her in situ in her habitat. Further observation of behaviours, especially feeding. Possibly find some clue to where she lives. If successful in this, tissue sample from shed skin or hair cells might be obtained. Of course, leaving Rosie at night exposes him to a new set of potential dangers. Moving in a nocturnal environment will be slow and difficult, while at the same time it will be easier for the Hungries to locate and hunt him. It's time to test the suit. Chapter 10. The day's work being over, the doors closed and the perimeter defences up, the soldiers and the scientists are free for an hour or two to do as they please. Dr. Fournier is in the engine room. He has let it be known that he uses the twilight hours to write up reports that he has no time to address during the day. As mission commander, he has a great many reports to write, and some of them are of a sensitive nature, so he is given orders that he should not be disturbed at these times. He plays classical music, mostly Wagner, on a portable CD player so old that Dr. Seeley says its continued functioning can only be explained using a new branch of physics. The CD player belongs to Dr. Penny, and it used to sit in the lab until Dr. Fournier requisitioned it. Hence Dr. Zakimwe and Penny having to make their own entertainment a cappella. The sound of the music, though soft, is enough to cover the sound of Dr. Fournier's voice. He is speaking into a radio set given to him by Brigadier Fry before the Rosalind Franklin set out from Beacon. He was given the set so that he could report on the actions and the conversations of his crew, with a specific focus on Colonel Carlyle, but there is seldom anything new to say. Only that the Colonel was doing his job and trying not to speak to Dr. Fournier any more than he had to. And now there is nobody to listen. Since the cockpit radio went out 9 days ago, the doctor's handheld receiver has been silent too. The airwaves are empty. Rosie is a bubble of meaning in a void of the absence of meaning. A void devoid of... He tries again. Dr. Alan Fournier calling Beacon. Dr. Alan Fournier calling Brigadier Fry. If you can hear me, please answer. Dr. Fournier calling Beacon. Colonel Carlyle reads a biography of Napoleon, one of the three books he brought with him when he came on board the Rosalind Franklin. Mulholland's account of the Emperor's life is often partial and poorly researched, but Carlyle appreciates his declamatory style. Truly, he reads, the years that witnessed Napoleon's fall were fruitful in paradox. The greatest political genius of the age, for lack of the saving grace of moderation, had banded Europe against him, and the most calculating of commanders had nonetheless given his enemies time to frame an effective military collaboration. Without hubris, he knows he is no genius, the Colonel looks in all the volumes he reads for echoes and precursors of his own mistakes. He has seen Beacon go from an armed camp to a proto-republic, and then he has seen that precarious democracy dismantle itself again. Now it is standing on the brink of something truly horrible, and Carlyle is 400 miles away on nursemaiding duty, having resigned his commission as an act of principle, and then taken it up again on direct orders from a superior who promised, in exchange, to leave him be and raise him no higher. Now the Colonel is wondering whose trap he fell into, Brigadier Fry's or his own. Possibly the answer is both. In any event, he has traded power for a clean conscience, and ended up with neither. Mulholland again. An overweening belief in his own powers and in the pliability of his enemies was the cause alike of his grandest triumphs and of his unexampled overthrow. Overthrow is a nicely judged word. It suggests a wrestler being flung to the mat. That only happens when you move outside your centre of gravity. Your enemy can't throw you if you have your feet firmly planted. Which Carlyle himself never did have, of course. He is not a politician. He's not even somebody who weighs his words, but he is, in the end, a conformist. A man whose centre of gravity can't easily be found because he has never taken the time to work out where it is he wants to stand. He only knows his limits when he actually meets them, in the world. As, for example, in his last face-to-face conversation with Brigadier Fry 7 months ago, just before the gates opened and Rosie passed through them on her outward journey. He was trying to make the Brigadier understand why the machinery of democracy is important, even if in some ways it makes Beacon run less efficiently rather than more. The Brigadier listened sober-faced to his argument, which was about checks and balances, safeguards and redundant systems. Her own position was that these things were luxuries that came with security, You could afford to think about redecorating your house only when you could be absolutely certain that the roof wasn't about to fall in. Her politicking illustrated this perfectly. She had demanded that the muster, Beacon's military, be granted a fixed proportion of the seats on councils and committees, including the so-called main table where overall policy was decided. Then she had expanded that wedge until the muster was the single biggest voting bloc. Now she was questioning the legitimacy of having any civilian presence at all on boards that decided on military matters. Fry listened politely as Carlyle made his case, and then she corrected him, punctilious to a fault. "You think I see democracy as irrelevant, Isaac?" "I don't. Please don't think that. When humankind was in the ascendant, when we ruled the world and the whole of creation bowed down to us, democratic institutions worked and nothing else did. The dictatorships were the sleazy corners where people were poor and miserable and governments were parasitic. Back then, I bowed to civil authorities and I followed orders and I never once asked myself if there was something I was missing. Democracy made sense. But when the plague struck, that all changed. It changed forever. You know what I see when I'm sitting at the main table? I see frightened sheep trying to decide which way to run. And if we put the sheep in charge of the farm, then we'll all of us die and the grass will grow over us. I don't intend to let that happen. Where is the muster in this metaphor, Geraldine? Carlyle had asked her. Assuming you're not sheep, what are you? Shepherds, perhaps? If you like. But shepherds only keep sheep safe until it's time to slaughter them. Fry's lip twitched, a movement of anger that she suppressed. We fight and we die for these people, she said, every day. And then they turn around and tell us to do the same thing on a smaller budget, with fewer soldiers. It's grotesque. Have we made mistakes? Yes, we have. But everybody in Beacon owes their lives to us, and they put us on a par with waste disposal and street clearance. There was a pause, a silence that Carlyle failed to fill. He could have said, "Your mistakes, our mistakes, killed thousands of men, women and children. They thought those planes were coming to save them, and we dropped white phosphorus on their heads. We burned them alive." So why didn't he? What kept him sitting there in dead silence when he could see her hiding those hideous deeds away in a box labelled collateral damage? The same thing that had made him resign his commission instead of denouncing Fry and standing against her. He had too much respect for the frameworks of authority, was too afraid of the harm that comes when they're shaken. Sometimes they needed to be shaken. Sometimes they needed to be dismantled and rebuilt from the ground up. He had never seen himself as the one best qualified to do that, never quite found enough sand to draw a line in. Still, he felt himself reaching a limit. He wasn't sure how much longer he could convince himself that doing nothing was the lesser evil. And Fry knew him well enough to see that change coming. Probably she was aware of it even before he was. Certainly she timed her intervention perfectly. "I have a new mission for you," she said, handing him the papers. "Top priority. It will take you away from Beacon for a while, which might be the best thing for all of us." Carlyle reached out his hand. He took the papers, abdicated yet again. There is a knock on the cockpit's open door. With no regret, the colonel abandons the contentious past for the unfathomable present. It's Lieutenant McQueen. "Poker game, sir," he says. "The men were wondering whether you'd join us for once." Carlyle hesitates. In all his previous postings, he spent as much time with the soldiers in his command as he could. He is fully cognizant of the importance of knowing his troops and being known by them. The Emperor held it as a maxim, Mulholland asserts, not to trust his weight to any bridge he had not personally tested and assayed. But the look on McQueen's face irks him. The lieutenant barely troubles to hide his contempt, which he will bring with him into the game. Every hand will become an index of the greater unspoken antagonism between them. Their mutual dislike will curdle the atmosphere and sap the morale of the other soldiers, which is already ebbing steadily. They stare at each other for a cold second, each acknowledging the unspoken agenda. And why is it still unspoken after all these months of enforced proximity? Carlyle has no idea. He was sure when they left Beacon that there would be a flare-up, a rebellious act or word that would discharge the lightning. But here they are, 7 months later, with the storm still building. "I think not, Lieutenant," Carlyle says evenly. "Thank you for the invitation, but I believe you'll be better able to relax without a senior officer present." "Yes, sir," McQueen says blandly. "Of course, sir. Enjoy your book." Which he wasn't managing to do even before the lieutenant's intrusion. He tries again, but still can't find the right mood of scholarly detachment. It melts in the universal solvent of recent memories. With a sigh, he sets Mulholland aside. The rearview mirror gives him a view along the flank of the vehicle. He can see the midsection airlock and the Greaves boys sitting in it, writing furiously with a stub of pencil so short it doesn't show between his pursed fingers. Is he still a boy, at age 15? Dr. Kahn argues that he is some kind of savant, but Carlyle can only ever see Greaves as the wide-eyed, silent child who made the arduous journey from London to Beacon, wearing a single, unchanging expression of shell-shocked wonder and dismay, clutching a toy or doll of some kind, not hugging it to his chest or trailing it along behind him the way Christopher Robin dragged Pooh Bear, but holding it, clenched in both hands like a talisman that he could raise, at need, against the world. "Probably as efficacious as anything else," the Colonel thinks. Chapter 11. Lieutenant McQueen returns to the game. "Just the five of us," he says. "His Majesty is wanking off over his war porn again." "The four of us," Sixsmith amends. "Phillips is on sentry." Sixsmith doesn't like it when McQueen criticizes the Colonel and tends to try to shut him down. She's one of those, and there are a fair number, who think Carlyle is a hero, because he got 11,000 people out of a city that used to have a population of 8.5 million. Apparently 99.9% attrition counts as success. And apparently it absolves that abject bastard of everything he did before the evacuation. It's like the burn runs never happened. It's like he didn't preside over the biggest peacetime massacre in British military history and lead decent, serving soldiers into a bloodletting that would stain their souls forever. This is what McQueen thinks, about himself, his job, and the Colonel. Britain had an army once that prized and rewarded blind obedience. Sometimes that led to monumental screw-ups, like the charge of the Light Brigade, but more often than not, it worked. It worked because of the context. A world where people fought against other people, century after century, in the same theatres and with the same rules of engagement. That was what it was like when McQueen himself enlisted, and he went along with it without much thought. Did well out of it, all things considered. Tours of duty in Syria, and then in Lebanon, got him commended 4 times and fast-tracked for promotion. Then the context changed, overnight. But some people didn't manage to change with it. Most of the people at the main table in Beacon are just the same old arseholes playing by the same old rules, throwing down the ace of clubs as though it still means something when the game is switched to Russian roulette. Why does McQueen hate the Colonel? Because the Colonel had the chance to turn it around. He was one of the highest-ranking officers to survive the global clusterfuck that happened when the Hungry Plague first broke out, and one of the most respected. He could have taken charge, and people would have rallied behind him. McQueen would have, just for one. And instead, he kept on obeying orders, even when the orders plainly made no sense. Firebomb the south of England, when there were people down there barricaded in their houses waiting for help to come. when there was civilian aircraft on the ground that could have been reclaimed and put into use, when your own damn troops were going to need that infrastructure if they were ever going to take one step outside the fences and the ditches and the minefields you had them hiding behind. Yeah, McQueen thinks. Actually, his metaphor doesn't hold. Russian roulette is exactly what the authorities in Beacon were playing. Only they cheated by putting a bullet in every chamber. And then they gave the gun to Colonel Isaac Carlyle to fire. No. He and Sixsmith will have to disagree on the matter of the firemen. But she makes a good point about the game. Four of them is below critical mass. You don't get proper poker without five or six around the table. He considers. Sentry duty is some more of the old man's play-it-by-the-book bullshit. They don't need a sentry. The movement sensors will trip if the Hungries come, and in any case, the Hungries don't. Not while Rosie is on silent running. And how is it that only the grunts draw night duties? As if divisions of rank matter a flying toss when they're sitting out in nowhere's armpit, with nothing coming in on the radio and no way of knowing if Beacon's even there anymore. It's time to strike a blow for the common man, and maybe goad the colonel into finally facing him head on. He goes through to the midsection platform where Phillips is standing by the airlock, rifle at parade rest, face at back in 5 minutes. Anything? McQueen asks sympathetically. Phillips nods towards the airlock. There's a light on in there, at about knee height. It takes McQueen a moment to realize that it's Stephen Greaves, writing by the light of a clip-on reading lamp with a 50-watt LED. Just the robot, Phillips says. Privately, McQueen has a few nicknames of his own for Greaves that are less family-friendly. He shakes his head as he stares, and taps his brow with the tip of his trigger finger. "Wonder what goes on in there," he says, although he really doesn't. He actually prefers to see Greaves as a kind of black box, like the Hungries. There may or may not be a person in there, but either way it's not his problem. He only has to deal with the output. "Listen," he says to Phillips, "I don't see any point in you staying out here. The perimeter is up. Nothing can get close to us without tripping an alarm. And the kid will raise a squawk if it comes to that. You might as well join the game." Phillips considers. McQueen watches him doing it, knows more or less what's going through his mind, and politely gives the other man as long as he needs. McQueen isn't his commanding officer, Colonel Carlyle is, and Carlyle's authority has to punch it out with Dr. Fournier's. But in Rosie's narrow spaces, rank and influence aren't the same thing. There is no question who looms largest in the private's mental landscape, false modesty aside. "Aye," Phillips says at last. "All right, then." McQueen slaps him on the shoulder. "Good man. If the colonel comes your way, tell him you are obeying a direct order." They go back into the crew quarters. Greaves watches them go, and gives them a minute or two to change their minds. When they don't return, he stands and strips. The top layer only. Underneath he's wearing something else entirely. A matte black suit set with small glassy studs, very much like the cat's eyes you find on road surfaces. In fact, the retro reflectors in cat's eyes were one of Greaves' starting points when he designed the suit, but more because of their simplicity and durability than because of what happens at the business end of them. It's not light he's hoping to diffract, but his own body heat. He's been working on the suit off and on for 4 months. The idea of it came to him even earlier than that, but it wasn't until they left Beacon that he had time to implement his design. He brought most of the raw materials with him, trusted to serendipity to provide the rest. The journey north offered uninterrupted stretches of whole weeks, with no official lab work to be done. Sometimes he worked through the night, appreciating the opportunity to progress on the suit without stopping every half hour or so to answer questions. Now it's done, as far as possible, given the constraints under which he has been working. He has confidence in the principle and in the overall design. Some of the components are workarounds and make-dos, and the tolerances are not what he would have liked, but now it's way past time for a field test. And he believes, all things considered, that it will work. In an ideal world, of course, he wouldn't risk his life on it. But the world is the way it is, and that's just what he's going to do. Chapter 12. Samarina Khan has retired to bed early. The curtains are drawn across her bunk, which signals that, awake or asleep, she is not to be disturbed. There are very few social niceties that have survived their 7-month voyage, but this one is accorded universal respect. Only a full-on emergency would cause any of the crew to pull those curtains aside, so it's unlikely that anyone will find out she's not alone in there. Getting 3 tiers of bunks into a 7-foot space meant cutting everything back to basics. Each set of bunks is really just a single recess separated into 3 by 2 rows of wooden slats lying across steel supports. John Seeley, whose bunk is above Dr. Khan's, has rolled back his mattress, which is easy enough as it's barely 1 inch thick, and removed 5 of the slats, opening his own bunk space up to hers. He is leaning down through the gap at an oblique angle so their upper bodies can meet up in a tight embrace. Any other kind of embrace would be impossible, all things considered. This is a risky enterprise, and they don't do it often. Tonight, Seeley has come to visit Rena in order to lift her mood after her official interrogation by Dr. Fournier. As the father of the child she's carrying, he feels this is the least he can do. But he finds Rena's mood surprisingly resistant to lifting. Surprisingly, that is, until she tells him what it is that's weighing on her mind. It's not the mission commander and his flaccid third degree. It's Greaves, her surrogate son.
"He's going to get himself killed," she whispers, sounding choked. "He's out there, with no camouflage and no backup, watching them. Not with binoculars, watching them from a few feet away. John, all it would take would be for him to trip or sneeze and... they'll eat him alive."
"We're all taking that chance every day we're out there," Seeley offers. "Greaves isn't stupid or reckless." Rena seems not to have heard him. "I think Fournier knows," she says, raising her voice a little more than is safe. Only the infield chatter of the poker players a few feet astern gives them any cover at all.
"He's just decided it doesn't matter. Stephen was forced on him at the last moment, and he's never treated him as a full member of the crew."
Her churning mind hits on another explanation.
"Or perhaps he sees it as an acceptable risk. He knows by now we're not going to find any environmental inhibitors. If Stephen comes up with a new idea, we might have something to show for all this."
"Maybe it is, at that," Seeley murmurs. "An acceptable risk," he means. "If Greaves can bottle the same lightning twice, grab another genius insight out of the ether the way he allegedly did with the E-blocker gel, then humankind might not die collectively in a ditch after all." As a fully paid-up member of said club, Seeley would see that as a win. But the odds are pretty long. Greaves might be the genius Rena says he is. Or then again, it might be that he just got lucky that one time. And Rena isn't even thinking about that right now. She knew Greaves when he was just a mostly broken little kid. She was there when his parents died, and through the queasy aftermath when he was an elective mute, when everybody thought he was mentally handicapped rather than a weird little alien wunderkind with no human emotions. Is it possible to slide through those judgments without them sticking to you? Seeley seriously wonders. The general feeling now is that Greaves is on the autistic spectrum, but how much of his weirdness is down to his brain's basic wiring, and how much of it is a trauma artifact? It's an academic question, but it's got real-world consequences. Rena more or less twisted the arm of everyone back in Beacon to get Greaves onto the mission roster. She knew how much he depended on her, feared how quickly he might fall apart without her. The supervisory group took a contrary point of view. They saw Greaves as a child first and foremost,
and as a gifted hobbyist rather than a serious practitioner. Then they looked at his psych assessments and saw something worse. A maladapted obsessive, damaged goods, and, E-blocker notwithstanding, a potential liability out in the field. Rena won her point in the end by making it a two-for-one deal. You want me, you take him too. To be fair, she didn't do that just to protect him. She genuinely thinks that Greaves can pull off a miracle here. A cure, a vaccine, a weapon, a better mousetrap. But all of that is predicated on the idea of his being different. As though his intellect cuts across the world at an angle nobody else is even aware of. Rena wouldn't admit to any of this, to thinking of Greaves as a Hail Mary play. But Celie knows full well she's watching the boy, waiting for the clouds to part and a dove to descend from heaven. It could be a long wait, in Celie's humble opinion. He's no psychologist, but he doesn't see Greaves as being on the spectrum. He sees him as a luckless kid who started out normal. Pretty bright, no doubt about it, but normal. Only to get bent all out of shape by horrendous tragedy. Then found himself trapped in Rena's hopes for him. At the orphanage in Beacon, where the teachers had given up on him because they were just volunteers, making it up as they went along, she took Greaves in hand, fed him books the way you'd feed a baby bird worms and broken up bits of bread, turned him into what he is now. Which is what? An eccentric genius or just an ill-equipped explorer, swaying on the rickety rope bridge between sanity and madness? The way Greaves acts, the things he does, it is extraordinary. But that's just another way of saying he's got his own coping mechanisms. It's not proof of anything. And yes, there's that one astonishing breakthrough. But Celie doesn't know anyone who accepts Khan's version of that story. A child genius finds an enzyme that leaches the sharp-smelling acids out of apocrine sweat and breaks them down into water and carbon dioxide, cooks it up in a saucepan and brings it to his best friend, biologist and epidemiological expert Dr. Samreena Khan to help him test it out. Occam's razor suggests a different sequence of events. No matter. Rena has her perspective, and she won't be shifted from it. Possibly she's the only person on Rosie's roster who actually worries about Greaves. Celia's tried many times to have this conversation with her, but it never takes. Gamely, but without much hope, he tries again. He's a member of the crew, Rena. Your co-worker, not your son. You've got to let him make his own choices. She looks at him as though he's just stuck out his hand to catch a ball that's already on the ground. Thank you, John, she says. That's an admirable summary of the blindingly obvious. But she doesn't say it with biting sarcasm. She says it with a catch in her voice. Her lips are twisting as she tries to hold in a flood of tears. So instead of bristling or snapping back, he wraps his arms around her. He gives way to her misery in absolute silence, her head buried in the angle of his neck and his shoulder. She's pulling him forward through the gap in the slats, so he feels like he's going to lose his purchase and fall headlong on top of her, then probably roll out sideways and give the whole game away. His T-shirt, which doubles as pajamas, is slowly but surely getting saturated with her tears. Rena slips straight from crying into exhausted sleep. Celie realizes then how hard this day has been on her. Her concern for Stephen is wholly real, of course, but it comes on top of a whole set of other concerns. She might catch a reprimand for her unauthorized pregnancy that will stop her career in its tracks, or the baby might do that all by itself, reprimand or not. She might have to give birth out here in the middle of nowhere. She might lose the baby. He wishes he was better at this stuff. He's in his 30s, but he can still count the relationships he's been in on one hand without running out of fingers. And none of them lasted. Maybe this one wouldn't have either if it hadn't been for a lack of condoms and self-control. It was leaving Beacon that caused that one fateful lapse. After being cooped up behind the fences and minefields for so long, getting out on the road, even inside an armor-plated sardine tin, felt like freedom. He and Rena found the only way to celebrate that didn't need to be applied for, signed off on, rubber-stamped, rationed or reported. Now they're stuck with the consequences. And with each other. Celie backs away from that thought in alarm. Rena is amazing, and he loves her more than he's ever loved anyone. He is in awe of her courage, the way she decides on a course of action and sticks to it, no matter what the world throws in her way. He admires her honesty, which turns white lies into red roadkill. Most of all, he loves her optimism, which is something he himself is really bad at. Rena never considers the possibility that the world might already have ended. She talks about the future without irony and even plans for it. As part of that, she has decided to keep their baby. She told him this in a way that left no room for argument. Celie thinks about what Beacon has become and is inclined, sometimes, to question the wisdom of that decision. But he has kept his doubts locked down. The last thing he wants to do is to leave her in any uncertainty ever that he's on her side, has got her back, will be there for her when the time comes, will stand up and be... Where are all these clichés coming from? He disentangles himself from Rena's sprawled body, rests his hand for a second or two against the indiscreet bump that is their burgeoning son or daughter, and levers himself back up through the gap in the bed frame. He does this with reluctance. Every time he removes the slats and visits her, he feels like one of the soldiers in The Great Escape, digging a tunnel to freedom. Which prompts a further reflection. Maybe it wasn't leaving Beacon after all that got him so drunkenly and irresponsibly joyous. Maybe it was her. Maybe it was Rena all the time. Chapter 13. Dr. Khan is not actually asleep. There is a state midway between sleep and waking in which she falls back into the past and relives it. Relives it in full HD with surround sound, all of her senses chipping in. She thinks of this state as replay, but as a scientist she knows it has another name. It is PTS, a post-trauma symptom. It comes over her two or three nights a week, and there's no point in struggling against it. If she tries to block the images, they impinge on her waking life, which is exponentially worse. Replay isn't like dreaming. Dreams have a logic and a structure that prevents you, while you're dreaming, from reflecting on the events you're wrapped up in. You take it all for granted because consciously questioning any one element would wake you up. But in her replays, Khan is aware of herself now as well as herself back then. She is her current self, sitting like a passenger in her former body. It troubles her to think that this might be how the Hungries experience the world. If there is any trace of their consciousness, their identity, behind the ramparts that the fungus has erected in their brains, then all they can do is watch. Their bodies now answer to a new master. She's walking. Through Guildford and Godalming. And places with even more innocuous names. Milford, Hazelmere, Hawkley. Heading south to Beacon in a column of about 800 desperate people shepherded. Harassed, it sometimes seems, by soldiers in urban camouflage colours. Their journey makes as much sense to her as the crazy careering of clown cars at the start of a circus act. Sometimes they're in trucks, buses, white vans and ambulances. Sometimes they're on foot. Then, Rena, sleep-deprived and starving, has no sense of why they keep getting out of the safe, warm cars and walking along the man-made valley of the A3. Now, Rena understands that when the road is blocked by the crashed, burnt-out remains of cars and trucks that ferried earlier waves of fleeing people, they don't have the time or the resources to clear it. The colonel gives the order each time to abandon the vehicles and trek to the next stretch of clear road. He sends his soldiers on ahead to find and requisition a whole new set of viable wheels. So their pace varies, and her mileage likewise. Sometimes she sits. Sometimes she lies on a truck bed staring at the sky, someone's limp arm draped across her legs, harsh breathing and sobbing all around her, mingling with her waking dreams. Mostly she walks, staggers, limps, shambles, hobbles along the endless road that has become their Calvary. There are two constants. The first is the Hungries. This is several years before the advent of E-blocker gel. They have no way of disguising their scent, their sounds, their body heat, so they are an endless, ever-moving invitation to dinner. The Hungries chase them down from behind, charge them from in front, assail them from both sides. The Colonel is their rampart, the other constant always in between. Don't look back, is his mantra. What's done is done, and here we are, still moving forward. He wields his rifle like a scythe, cutting their persecutors off at the knees with precise, horizontal sweeps of the weapon. He hands out guns to the refugees, teaches them the principles of covering fire. He rigs up flamethrowers from oxygen cylinders and insecticide sprayers. Once he fills a Bedford van with petrol and C4 and rolls it down an incline they have just climbed, so that a dip in the road becomes a lake of fire in which hundreds of Hungries drown and sink. They are in hell, but the devil is on their side. He's changing in their minds. Most of them thought of him as the fireman before this, because of the burn runs that turned most of southeast England into a carbonized desert. Now he is the old man, spoken as though you know him, whether he's ever said a single word to you or not. From time to time people join their column. They are never turned away. The gap between exposure to the infection and ego death is so short for most people that the risk of accepting newcomers is non-existent. The few who, defying the mass of statistics, turn more slowly and gradually are killed with a single bullet to the head. Dr. Khan steps over their bodies and walks on. She is hallucinating from sheer fatigue. The Colonel is Moses and they are his children. Don't look back. The Hungries part before him like a sea. Half-congealed blood is the ebb tide, making the pavement suck at her feet as she walks. The air smells of sweat and blood and shit and cordite, petrol and plasticine and overcooked meat. He holds them to him. He walks them home. The A3 becomes impassable. One vast 1,000-car pile-up strewn with the half-eaten dead. They abandoned it and walk through deserted villages. In one of them, on an overpass above the road they left not long before, they find a small cadre of survivors fighting for their lives. They've closed off the ends of the bridge with junk and repurposed white goods and retreated to the centre, but Hungries have swarmed over their barricades to assail them from both sides. The Colonel is bringing salvation, but he brings it too late. Courageous last stands like this deconstruct from the edges into the centre. Bitten once, the brave defenders fight on for a few seconds, then they stiffen momentarily as the fuse of their consciousness burns to its end. A heartbeat later, they've turned around and joined the scrum, bearing down on their nearest neighbours and dragging them to the ground. Khan watches it happen to a woman who is swinging an aluminium baseball bat, a man with a dustbin-lid shield and a carving knife, a blonde cherub who has been entrusted with the family's lop-eared spaniel. The dog is her first meal. By the time the Colonel's fighting wedge breaks through to the centre of the group, there's no group left. The people they hoped to rescue became enemies, became targets, are all gone. Almost all. As the soldiers move around, handing out full metal coup de grace, Khan's gaze finds a small boy, maybe 5 or 6 years old, lying in between two adults. Their bodies are bowed outwards, shielding him from attack on either side. They're like a pair of brackets around him, cordoning him off from the world. The couple bears so many wounds, bite marks, incisions and lacerations, in the man's case a gunshot wound to the head, that it is impossible to piece together how they died. Certainly they were trying to protect the child, who has no visible wounds or injuries at all. The soldier touches the stock of his rifle to the boy's temple. Wait! Khan shouts.
Just in time. The boy lets out a breath. Someone says, "This one's alive," and someone else swears.
The soldier steps back, a look of shock and fear replacing the stolid frown on his face. When Khan steps in and claims the boy, scoops him up in her arms, nobody says a word. Until Carlyle nods and tells them to move.
Replay ends here. The ordeal wasn't over, they didn't reach Beacon for another 3 days, but it had entered another phase, for Khan, at least. She had acquired a role, a function, keeping the silent, wide-eyed little boy alive. It kept her alive, too. She was and is convinced.
Stillness was Stephen's natural modality even then. Perhaps it was the last thing his mother or father said to him. Lie still and they might not notice you. Don't make a sound. But over the hours and days that followed, as they slogged on towards codename Beacon, that stillness never left him. Khan believes he had it long before his parents were killed and partially eaten while he watched.
It's a wonderful and scary thing. When there's nothing to run or reach for, Stephen doesn't run or reach. He can fold himself down, his volition, his emotions, until, seen from any angle except straight on, through any eyes except hers, they're invisible. For a scientist, that's an amazing asset. But it's more than that. The stillness took a different tincture on the day she met him, the day his parents died. Khan knows better than anyone how far Stephen has come, how much he has achieved. He was only 12 when he synthesized the E-blocker gel that saves their lives on a daily basis, though everyone credits her with that discovery. He was one of the first to suggest that Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, as the fungus that was responsible for the hungry plague, and then his name was mysteriously omitted from the paper Caroline Caldwell ultimately submitted. He has proved that the pathogen grows directly into the nervous system of its hosts and controls them by means of mycotransmitters, long-chain fungal proteins that mimic and hijack the signaling apparatus of the mammalian brain. In the whole of Beacon, there is nobody who has a fuller understanding of what the human race is up against. But it seems to Khan that a part of Stephen is still lying on the damp asphalt of a Surrey street. In parenthesis, waiting for an all-clear that will never come.
Chapter 14 10 years after the breakdown, the night is a foreign country, and not a friendly one. Its borders begin at your door. Unless you want to mount a major expedition, an armed incursion, you do not trespass. Nonetheless, Stephen Greaves is walking through the dark. There are field glasses that turn dark into light, but he doesn't have those. A single pair of them sits in the gun locker on board the Rosalind Franklin, squirreled away for the exclusive use of the snipers. Greaves could have retrieved them from the locker by breaking the access code, but he could not have erased all the traces that he had done so. There would have been unpleasant conversations. So he relies on starlight and a quarter moon, on a pocket torch that he uses very sparingly, and on his very clear recollection of walking this route by day. The last of these three is the most reliable. Greaves carries a map in his mind and charts his progress on the map by means of an imagined red dot, moving along a fractally plotted course. Where the stars and that slender rind of moon cease to be a help, as when he is walking between high trees which shut out their light completely, he expands the detail of his map so that it warns him of ditches, potholes, boulders, and barbed wire. He can do this almost indefinitely, the limit being his eye's ability to resolve detail. Whatever he has seen, even once, he can remember. He has come well equipped for this short but perilous journey. A bulky kit bag slung across his shoulder carries spare batteries for the torch, his notebook, a bottle of water, and an emergency signal flare. Also a knife, although he can't justify its presence. If he is attacked, he will not use it. He has a deft hand with a scalpel, and has dissected dozens of cadavers with no qualms at all, but the thought of cutting into a living body, human or animal or hungry, is nauseating, impossible. Like telling a lie or initiating touch, it is simply not in his behavioural repertoire.